You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 101 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks. It's time to kick off the next 100.
Oh, the next 100 starts here. But if you haven't done so yet, and this is something that you're interested in, if you were listening along with all of the greatest Pelton Cast moments, there's no need because you'll remember them all perfectly. But if you haven't done so yet, go ahead and take a look at our retrospective of the first 100 episodes. What I like to call the worst segments.
Because I picked all the segments where you talked great about Jim Mora?
Yes. The best of the worst.
That's about right. But you should listen to this podcast first, actually, because that one is not very time sensitive.
Including those Jim Mora segments. Every single one. I could just imagine you on your computer just like, oh yes.
I mean, honestly, I didn't remember until I went back to listen.
Bring on the Jim Mora take. I don't remember ever. It was like every single time I expressed a Jim Mora take, it was on there. You included the one Percy Harvin touchdown. You included that just to try to even out the Jim Mora takes.
And the Jermaine Kearse touchdown. Okay. It was an impressive
feat. I had a good read on one football game ever and a bad read on Jim Mora over and over and over again.
It's true.
I'm probably going to say right now that I think that he's the worst, and all of a sudden we'll start loving Jim Mora in like 2 years.
He's going to come back as an assistant coach at UW. Yes. All right, we'll see about that one.
He'll be the head coach of Thai high school football, and then I'll start loving it. He'll dominate the what do they call the league?
The Seamount League.
The Seamount League.
Which I'm okay with because Mount Rainier isn't in the Seamount League anymore.
Oh, wow. You guys have moved up?
Yeah.
Well, good for you. More room for Jim Mora to dominate.
All right, should we celebrate a few things, but first crack open what we're drinking for episode number 101?
You saw this teased on the Peltoncast Instagram, which if you haven't done so, you should go and follow. There's a lot of hot content on there.
It's active. It's picking up steam.
Yeah, because you let me have access to it, unlike the...
Unlike Twitter?
Unlike Twitter or the editing of the Best Of podcast.
Well, I definitely was not going to let you have access to the editing of the Best Of podcast.
That's... No room for feedback there.
You know how many hours I spent editing that podcast? I spent a lot.
And you managed
time.
To not include me and the famous Cousin Katie talking about Ballers on HBO.
I'm still not even sure what episode this is.
I demanded it. The people demanded it. I could tell you exactly what episode it was.
Okay. Well, you didn't do that previously, so it was not.
You managed to find every single... You had timestamped every... There's the word Jim Mora. You have that catalog. You're like, throw all those in there. Me and Cousin Katie brilliantly talking about Ballers on HBO. And you're like, we just don't have time for that one. Left on the editing floor.
Anyways, what we're drinking today is the new Rainier Radler. The newest seasonal offering from our friends at Rainier Brewing Company, which with their motto, for the days when the mountain's out, which the mountain was decidedly not out today. Not even close.
Still, I kind of like that.
Oh, it's a good slogan. Yeah. And it was on Saturday when we were drinking these and... Barbecuing, grilling in the backyard here. It was a really very spring setup, and it was so short-lived.
Cheers to last Saturday.
Yeah. What a great one day of nice weather.
It was a beautiful spring while it lasted.
So the Rainier Radler it's not a traditional Radler where it's beer mixed with a fruit juice. In this case, it seems to all have been brewed together, which, among other things, gives it a higher alcohol content than most Radlers. It's actually pretty similar to straight Rainier in that regard. I believe it's like 4.2% versus 4.6%, although I can't find that on the can now.
Yeah, no, it's not on the can, but this is 4.2. I think regular Rainier is 4.9.
Okay. Well, what is your review since we had this, obviously, on Saturday before we're going to enjoy this now?
I think that it's perfect for a sunny day. I don't know about right now at 10:32 p.m. how it's going to taste. I had one earlier. And it was fine. I'm not going to say that I'm the biggest Radler fan, but if it's hot and sunny out, I would always enjoy one.
So I have liked historically grapefruit Radlers, but not the lemonade technically usually is called a shandy rather than a Radler. But this one I've enjoyed. I like the citrus hint in there.
Still right now?
Yeah.
All right.
No, it's good. It's flavorful. I don't need to be refreshed at this point, but it's refreshing anyway.
I always need to be refreshed.
It is a higher price point than your classic Rainier.
Oh, yeah. It's $10 for a six-pack of Tallboys. Whereas the regular Rainier is like $5 for a...
I believe that was $7 for the Tallboy, as I was comparing this as I purchased it earlier.
Like, all that lemon zest ain't cheap.
I guess not. So it'll be interesting to see if people prefer the slightly more expensive version, especially given like Rainier's appeal. But I definitely would mix it in the rotation.
All right.
All right, let's get to toasting. And let's start with the winners of our NCAA tournament bracket pools. We start on the men's side, where only one person correctly picked both participants in the final. Obviously, many of us had Villanova.
Very impressively, though. Picking the exact final game, I'm very impressed with whomever this was.
But taking Michigan as a 3 seed was an impressive upset. So before the final game was even played, we had our winner, who is known on ESPN, at least, is Beardmonger.
Uh-huh. I like where he's going there.
With the bracket Seattle's best pho. A bracket, sadly, you will not be seeing anytime soon on the podcast. Maybe for like 2030 if we get there. So we don't know who you are, but please let us know.
Identify yourself, Beardmonger.
And then we will get in touch with you about whether to do a gift certificate to Tacos Chuki's or perhaps a Pelton Cast hat if you prefer that.
Or if you don't live in Seattle.
Right. That being a natural reason for you not to prefer that. I did think it was notable that among the members of our family, the winner, finishing third overall, Baby Fantasy Genius.
They don't call him Baby Fantasy Genius for nothing.
I mean, you did invent that nickname before he possibly could have played fantasy sports.
I mean, you've been calling him that for so long. But you said you wouldn't listen to the tapes.
Well, but he actually, it got invented on one of the...
Yeah, you said you listened to when he was called Baby Fantasy Genius.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, because that was on episode 25, which another loyal listener mentioned is their favorite segment, when you revealed that he fell in love with the song Freak-a-Leak by Petey Pablo. Which, sadly, is no longer his favorite song.
You just, like, you remember it all perfectly like a machine, but us talking about Ballers on HBO, you have no recollection of.
No, I had to go look that up. I didn't remember that. I searched for that one.
But congrats to Baby Fantasy Genius for finishing third.
Yeah, that was a really impressive effort by Baby Fantasy Genius. As I scroll to try to figure out who it was who said this, and I don't know, I can't find it. On the women's side, only one of us in the pool picked a team besides UConn. So when UConn got knocked off in Friday's semifinals by Notre Dame, it presented an opportunity for loyal listener Noah Cohen to emerge victorious if Mississippi State, his choice, won the final. Alas, they didn't, because Notre Dame struck again with Arike Ogunbowale hitting two incredible shots, two incredible game winners in the Final Four, the latter of them an off-balance three-pointer in the final seconds of the championship game to deliver the Fighting Irish their first NCAA championship since 2001, and perhaps more importantly, deliver you, Tristan, the championship of our women's tournament.
They don't call him the Fantasy Genius for nothing. I will be taking the Tacos Chuki's gift certificate. Thank you.
I mean, I'll probably just pay for you at Tacos Chuki's at some point here.
Best of nine people who were in the women's tournament pool.
It was not a stiff competition. So that actually was the better entry for you for someone who was trying to maximize their chances of a Tacos Chuki's gift certificate. But alas, not because of the fact that it didn't even get won by anyone.
It got won by someone.
I mean, okay.
Someone right here. I'm sorry, Noah. You are so close. But you'll never be able to tell how smug I'm looking right now.
Oh, I'm sure he can tell. We can maybe Instagram that.
We're Instagramming too much.
All right, while we're here, we also decided to give out hats to a couple of randomly selected people who offered feedback of their favorite memories from the PeltonCast using the hashtag PeltonCast100 or PeltonCast144 on Twitter. Although, by the way, then I went and looked at iTunes, and it turns out that iTunes has a completely accurate count of the number of episodes, and it's 147. So I was shortchanging us a little
bit. Somebody, I think, said PeltonCast 149 also.
You know, just any number in that range is an acceptable number. So anyway, among the people, the loyal listener who delivered that feedback, and thanks so much for sharing your favorite episodes. We got a lot of great comments on there that we retweeted on many of them on the Twitter account. But the two winners, a former third Pelton brother, Mike Bate at Mike_Soros.
How did you choose these people? By a
random number generator in Excel is one does.
All right. Okay.
And then also the other winner, Michael Roch, a.k.a. @LionButt_3.
Lion Butt.
So get in touch with us about sending you one of those hats, getting us your address.
Are the Peltoncast DMs open?
I don't know if they're not. I don't think they are. So Peltoncast Peltoncast@gmail.com. Well, that's the email I use for the Pelton mailbag.
Also, if you have questions about basketball.
Yeah. Which we are doing a mailbag today. So it's a little bit appropriate, but not really.
Why are the DMs not open on the Pelton? Who are you worried about sliding in there?
I don't know. I just don't even know where those would go. Like, I don't have that tab up on TweetDeck, so I would never see it. Because I run everything through TweetDeck. So.
Okay.
So should we talk about tacos?
Let's talk about tacos.
And burritos. Because this week, you had a little of both, perhaps?
Oh, I had a lot of both.
So our review this week was of Taco Street in the Othello neighborhood along MLK, along the light rail route. And you had both tacos and burritos.
I had both tacos and burritos, and I had a breakfast burrito. That's right. Today, I ate every single meal from Taco Street.
Wait, seriously? I stopped
there on my way into work and got a breakfast burrito, and then I stopped there on the way out of work and got both tacos and a burrito.
Now, that is such impressive commitment. How big was the breakfast burrito? Is it a full-size burrito?
It is giant.
Oh, man.
Did you have the burrito?
I had the burrito.
It's the same size with a shitload of eggs and potatoes in it and stuff.
Oh, that sounds so good, except that I prefer breakfast tacos because of the ability to get different meats. Sadly, because of the fact that I went with the I wanted to go there twice because I wanted to go get tacos one time and a burrito a second time separately. But as much as the breakfast tacos were calling my name, when I saw the El Pastor burrito, I decided I had to try that.
Okay. I had one of those tonight.
What was your review of that?
It's okay.
So, I mean, I felt the El Pastor quality was strong. It was loaded with the consistency of the ingredients was good in terms of, you know, my burrito test that you have to not have everything all clumped together, but you're getting a little bit of rice, a little bit of beans, a little bit of meat, etc.
Yeah.
There was slices of pineapple in there with the El Pastor, which is a huge plus in my opinion. But the downside was it was very dry.
It was dry. It needed something else in there. It needed
sour cream or guac.
Sour cream, guac, some cut up tomatoes, which I know you're against, but it just needed another color in there, right?
Yes.
It was very brown. Everything about it was very brown. And if you threw in one other thing, I feel like it would have pulled the whole thing together.
Yes.
You
like
know?
Like the rug.
So the way that I like burritos is I either want a lot of stuff in there or I want basically just meat. And I want the meat to be like almost wet. Right? I want
kind of greasy?
Yeah. I want it to be greasy and wet, and I want the tortilla to be greasy. I mean, I want it to be the Tacos Chuggies burrito, which is smaller, right? So it's easier to do.
I mean, you've never had a great mission-style burrito.
Never.
You're cutting Chipotle here?
Is that a mission-style burrito?
It is, yes.
Okay. Then I have had many great mission-style burritos.
But I mean, like, one from the Mission District in San Francisco. And
what are we talking here? What's in there?
I mean, it's similar stuff, but I mean, number one, the consistency is amazing. Like, these are perfectly crafted burritos. And number two, at least at La Taqueria, which was my favorite of the two over El Farolito,
which
like
are
the primary
number
two.
One burrito place in the country, right?
Yes.
You're talking about, you're like, oh, yeah. Wow, the consistency is amazing. As if all mission style burritos are like that. This is like the burrito place in the entire country.
But I'm saying those are better than Tacos Chuggies burritos.
Great. Of course.
But you're saying that's your stand. That's like the platonic ideal, and that's what I'm disagreeing with.
Those are the two different types of burritos that I want. What is in a mission style burrito? What are the same things
in a mission style burrito? It's just well done.
Is it just beans, rice, and meat though?
I mean, there's definitely guacamole in La Taqueria.
See, that's enough. I'm saying I needed one more color in there.
Yeah, no, I agree.
I need a green or a red or a white in there. I need something else.
If I got the burrito again, I would just order sour cream with it, probably.
Which you can do.
Yeah, that's a perfectly reasonable option. Or I guess in hindsight, I could have gotten some salsa, like from the salsa bar, and poured it on the top.
Which I did.
But that, I don't like that as much as having it in the burrito, like part of the just inherent structure of the burrito.
So they're a little bit different than Tacos Chuki's in as much as they're a little bit more about the salsas. Tacos Chuki's is not a big salsa place, right? It's about kind of eating the food that is presented to you.
No.
But this is kind of about the salsas. The green sauce is really good. It's like a creamy salsa. The red sauce, though, it is hot.
It's got a kick.
Oh, man. It was very hot.
To clean out the sinuses?
But I liked it a lot. I thought it was a good sauce. To me, the real stars of the show, though, the burrito, I would say, was fine. I probably would not get the burrito again. The tacos, though, that's what I like, is just a basic taco. I'm pretty sure they're frying their own tortillas. I think the meat is pretty good. It's simple. It's just basically meat and cilantro and cut up onions. That's what I want in a taco.
That's all you need.
And did you have those?
No, I didn't have the tacos.
Oh, so you just had the burrito.
One time.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So I had lengua, pastor, and carne asada.
Which was your favorite of those three?
Pastor.
The king of the burritos.
It's the king of taco meats. I had lengua for the first ever time. So it was a little bit of a new flavor for me. And I probably need to have it more. I need to get more accustomed to it.
Little listener Jimmer had some feedback on your El Pastor is the king of the taco meats take, saying that he, like, whenever he goes anywhere, orders lengua because of the fact that if that can be done well, it's a sign that they can do anything well.
Interesting. I mean, that's why I got the lengua, is because of Jimmer's response there.
Yeah. I've definitely had it in the past, but I don't really remember how I felt about it. Apparently not strongly enough that I continued to order it. How was the breakfast burrito?
So the breakfast burrito, it probably needed salsa also. Uh-huh. I feel like, again, it was just a lot of the same things. I mean, I ate it with glee.
So you got potato, eggs, and meat in there?
Bacon, potato, eggs, and cheese.
Yeah.
It just didn't feel enough removed from a breakfast burrito that I can make myself.
That's reasonable.
Does that make sense? There was no, like, a lot of times when you eat food at restaurants, you're like, I cannot recreate this. You know, to my greatest abilities, I will never be able to make this item. And that wasn't, I love all breakfast burritos. I would eat the breakfast burrito again for sure. And I ate it with the green salsa, which I probably should have even gotten more of. And another one where it's just like, put some tomatoes in there, chop up some tomatoes and put them in. A little bit more. Just needed a little bit extra to it.
Okay.
If there would have been chopped up tomatoes and onions together, something like that, plus, let's say, sour cream or something, it would have been a very good burrito.
All right, so what's your rating for Taco Street?
It's weird because I like Taco Street a lot, but I feel like I'm giving it a 78.
A 78? Holy crap, wow. I was, like, worried that my score was going to be too low and that I would just go with whatever your score was because of the fact that I didn't have a chance to try as much. But I was still thinking of it as probably in the 85 range.
I mean, I'm trying to be harsh here, you know? I'm trying to really judge these places.
Uh-huh.
And to me, the difference between even the food truck, like the meat at Fonda La Taqueria.
Taqueria La Fondita.
Okay, so it's really hard for me to remember the name. Taqueria La Fondita. It's just the food truck in White Center.
Yes.
The difference between their meat or what they're offering at like a $2 burrito and the tacos there, it's really a pretty big difference.
Interesting. You think it's that much better?
And it's really not even comparable. I mean, the tacos are good.
Yeah.
But they're just not exceptional in any way. I don't think they stand out from kind of your average food truck tacos.
So I visited another food truck this week, which I don't think is going to be formally part of the search for Seattle's best tacos.
But it does lead naturally into the question that we have.
Wait, does it? Okay. Yes, I guess it. Oh, yes, it does. I went to Taqueria Los Potrillos in the Renton Highlands on Saturday. That was my second tacos of the week, and it was similar to Taqueria La Fondita, but probably not quite as good, I would say. So, you know, maybe in the 83 range, I would say.
Wow.
But it reinforced the fact that, like, all taco trucks have very good tacos, and they're not really. There's not really that much gradation to me among them.
I totally
agree.
They're
all pretty similar. It's a high replacement level, but hard to beat that.
And they're all good.
Yeah.
Right? You're never like disappointed that you ate at a taco truck. You love it every time.
No.
And basically every taco truck.
All right, so you're right. This does lead naturally into the question, which is also from loyal listener Jimmer at Jim Jimson Jr. on Twitter. It's not technically a question. It's more of an observation, but we decided to answer it as a question to go with this week's mailbag theme. Either y'all are supremely dedicated to podcast content, or you're using these food ratings as cover for some sort of rare compulsive disorder, but I don't know how y'all can eat one style of food for weeks at a time.
The answer is all three.
I mean, I don't think we're using it as cover.
Some compulsive disorder.
I mean, number one, it's not like we're actually eating these things for every meal. Like, the most excessive...
I eat tacos for every meal today.
Well, okay. But the most excessive I went was a couple weeks ago when I first went to Spokane. I think there was like four different tacos in a 5-day span.
You had a lot of tacos.
At that point. Yeah, it was a fair number of tacos, but it's still eating other meals in between days. So it's not like every meal is strictly devoted to a single cuisine.
I mean, to me, it's like the exact opposite. It's that I can use these searches as an excuse to eat these foods that I want to eat for every meal.
I think that's a good way to put it, yes.
And it's like...
You're justifying it.
I want to eat tacos, especially these tacos that we're having, almost every day. The tacos taste just as good to me today as they will tomorrow, especially because we're going to different places.
Oh, that's convenient. Because I was going to quote from the great Chuck Klosterman, who once wrote in describing how he ate nothing but McNuggets for an entire week for a story he did while he was working in Fargo, North Dakota. If something is good today, it will be good tomorrow. Variety is overrated. Variety is for philanderers. And I've always loved that.
Variety is for philanderers. See, I don't know if I necessarily agree with that. It's because we're having different things all the time. But like when we were doing our search for Seattle's best burger, I ate numerous recreational burgers. You know,
it's not like you got sick of burgers.
I fucking love burgers. And I love burgers all the time.
I mean, I sort of find myself thinking man, it's sad I'm not eating as many burgers.
I miss them.
Great from a health standpoint.
It's like... Nonetheless. After I had these tacos today for two meals, tomorrow after I play basketball, am I going to go to Taco Bell? Of course I am.
Well, I mean, that's a whole different genre of food. All things considered.
But still, it's in the taco family. Am I going to go to Taco Time at some point, probably this weekend, because Baby Fantasy Genius demands it? Of course I am. It's not going to change anything.
Classic Baby Fantasy Genius.
And if I were a place where they had really good tacos, I would eat those tacos again.
The
one thing I want to say is I felt like dumplings a little bit. Like I got not sick of dumplings by the end, but it was partially just because it was a lot of times just me and Mrs. Fantasy Genius, or just me and you. I was consuming a lot of dumplings.
It was a high number of dumplings, that's for sure.
And so I felt like my stomach still wasn't recovered from the search for Seattle's best dumpling.
Well, hopefully the search for Seattle's best tacos/burrito is helping you improve your stomach. That's why I was assuming this is for digestive purposes. Do we want to talk about a place for next week? I had a thought. I don't even remember if they're officially on the list or not.
I'm all ears.
But I think I'm going to this place.
Always ordering off menu.
Marination.
Oh.
Which is not really something you think of as a taco place, but they do have tacos on the menu. So
yeah, I can do marination.
Do you want to do that?
They're going to come up later in a response to one of the questions for me.
Nice. Intriguing. That's a tease there. Should we then get to this week's special mailbag?
Absolutely, we should.
All right. So we solicited questions on Twitter earlier, again, because we had a few coming. We're going to save one for a later segment, but had several good ones, so let's get to them now. First up, from loyal listener Chris Wheeler, at Chris Wheeler, WA, Fort Washington, asking for a friend. You bring your Connecticut native partner from Brooklyn to Seattle for a weekend trip that doubles as a Pacific Northwest sales pitch. What do you eat? What else do you do? And so my follow-up response to this was, is this a summer trip or not? Because that, to me, there are two very different answers to this question. And Chris clarified to say he'd like to hear both options explored.
Both options explored?
Yes.
I was just thinking this is summer because you probably should never try to sell Seattle when it's not summer.
Exactly. I mean, that's the big thing. That's going to be your selling point to someone from the Northeast, is how amazing Seattle is during the summer.
So a few things. Loretta's, obviously. Right? First stop, Loretta's.
It's convenient because you'll be coming from SeaTac Airport. You can stop there on your way to downtown. It's right on the way.
Ultimate sneak. Stop at Loretta's on the way.
Sneak would be if you had a long layover and went to Loretta's during the layover. That's the ultimate sneak.
Beecher's on the way out of the airport, then hit up Loretta's.
Yes.
But so Loretta's.
Maybe put the Beecher's on your Loretta's burger.
Oh, that's not bad.
I don't know how that would go.
You could show your partner the fourth best burger in the country.
It's true. Undeniably true.
If it's summer, there's the outdoor patio seating. It's affordable. It's very nice, right? It's just a great place to be. Laid back environment in South Park. You know, you just feel good when you're there.
Yeah.
Another place I was thinking, also kind of in the same area, is I feel like you probably need to go to Alki.
Yeah.
I don't know how.
Probably the best view in the city. Well, no, I'm sorry, second best view in the city, because the best view in the city is Cary Park.
And I was thinking Marination at Alki.
That's a good spot.
To include both the food and a place to be.
Right.
The other thing to me, this doesn't appeal to you as much. This could work in the spring months, maybe the fall, so probably not the dead of winter. But I feel like the things that Seattle has going for it, right, are the clean air, but also the proximity to both mountains and water.
That is accurate.
So you've got a couple of options here. To me, number one would be going on like a nice hike, right?
Mm-hmm.
Something like Lake 22 or Rattlesnake Ledge. And then drinking beer at a brewery after.
Okay.
So this is...
But definitely not eat at that brewery, right?
Yeah, do not eat at the brewery. Get tacos from somewhere else. Maybe just get some tavern burgers to go. So here's your options. You go on the hike, you get a six-pack of Fremont beer, you pack it in, you pack it out, then go to a brewery in the area. This wouldn't work for Lake 22, but places like No Boat Brewing. I think these are both technically in Snoqualmie, but they're like 30 miles from each other. No Boat Brewing, Drew Brew, which is on the pass. Going to one of those places when it's sunny after you've hiked, you feel good, and you're like, I've really like worked out my body here. I can drink a lot now.
You are much more up to date on breweries in Snoqualmie than I realized, or than I am.
When the Drew Brew is like on the pass.
Like right on the road?
It's very convenient. But so the other thing is, to me, going to Port Townsend.
Taking the ferry?
Especially if you're taking a ferry. But you can go there. You can go to Fort Warden. There's a sandy beach there. If it's nice outside, it's not too hot. You can go and see some steampunks in Port Townsend. It's a great place for a day trip.
You have curated quite the experience here, as long as it's the summer. I mean, I think the ferry could be fun outside the summer months, too, as long as it's not like actively stormy. I think that's a lot of good suggestions. I feel like Lake Union is a really underrated spot. Like, everyone goes to the waterfront in Pike Place, obviously. But Lake Union is pretty great because it's like right in the middle of town. And there's a lot of good stuff around it. Certainly a lot of good food sprouting up in the South Lake Union neighborhood. So I think that's a good spot to go hang out. Maybe go check out Mohai if that's something you're interested in.
Which it should be.
That's another activity that could be better if it's not nice outside. But... on the other end of their Gasworks Park, and especially if the person happens to be your partner happens to be a fan of the movie 10 Things I Hate About You, and you can explain
which they better be.
I mean, that's a key test in any romantic relationship. Does this person like 10 Things I Hate About You? But explain that that's where the paintball scene was shot.
Maybe drive to Rogers High School or whatever.
Isn't that Stadium High School?
Stadium High School.
I believe that's Stadium High School. That's a bit of a hole.
This is assuming that your partner is a super fan of 10 Things I Hate About You and wants to do a 10 Things I Hate About You tour. Did they go to the Troll in the movie?
I can't remember anymore.
There's definitely movies where people have gone to the Troll.
We should next curate like the trip if you're a big super fan of Singles.
Okay, so here's another idea, though.
Say Anything?
Along the lines of what you're saying, is if it is not as nice, you've got the Fremont Brewing and Schilling right there in Fremont. It's pretty laid back. I just feel like you want to stay out of the greater downtown corridor.
I agree with that.
And also,
especially because that's going to be your experience if you live here. You're not going to be spending time downtown that much if you're living here. You're going to be in the neighborhoods.
Well, and like, you're not going to go to Capitol Hill because this person already lives in Brooklyn. You know,
you don't need to see that.
That's like, I'm just saying,
got that experience.
No offense to Seattle, but like a lot of the food-wise, I feel like Seattle's probably not going to compare to the fares that are available to this person living in New York.
Oh, by the way, with Lake Union, you could hit up Ivers. That's a good spot. I feel like we're kind of seafood light at this point.
Yeah, seafood light.
But like it's Northwest cuisine. That's
I suppose so.
I mean, not that Ivers is necessarily the best representative of that, but you know, I love Ivers.
These are all options for what you could do.
I think we've given you some thoughts here. I'm ready to chew on. All right, let's move on to Lucas Crowley at Mariners Lover 11 asked, what is the best milkshake in Seattle, bonus for flavor? So
this is all you. I don't drink milkshakes, really.
Really? Well, we've already answered this. It's the Ube Shake at strictly the Ballard Lil Woody's location is the best milkshake in Seattle.
And that's using Full Tilt Ube ice cream?
Yes. Beyond that, I'm not sure what my pick for number two would be. That's so clearly number one, I don't really even have another answer.
Wow. Find out on summer 2026.
Yeah, Seattle's best milkshake.
Search for Seattle's best milkshake.
That might be more of the midwinter one that we do in a briefer tournament.
We're having milkshakes in the midwinter.
Oh, right. Fair point. All right, next up. What would Jake Browning have to do this year for KP to jump off the wagon, asks Jimmy at Jimmy_Lee1. So I was thinking about this, and I think a good metric to use here in terms of like a statistical ballpark of what I'm expecting is College Football Reference's adjusted yards per attempt stat.
This is like the nerdiest version of TBA what we're doing right now.
It really is. So adjusted yards per attempt takes yards per attempt, and then it adds in touchdowns and interceptions, like various yardage penalties or bonuses based on those. And I don't love the touchdown like bonus because so much of that is just, do we run it in from the two or pass it in from the two? Like, that's why Jake Browning's touchdown total declined from 43 to 19 last year, not because he was actually that much worse a player. But Jake Browning in his career, he had 7.7 adjusted yards per attempt as a freshman, 9.9 as a sophomore, 8.6 last season. So I think if he got below 8.6, I think at that point it would be a legitimate question to ask whether one of the freshmen might possibly be better than him at this point. As long as he's above that, it is not even to me a legitimate question, because it's unlikely that these guys are going to come in and be better than Jake Browning was as a true freshman. And then, as we discussed a few weeks ago, when he first announced his intention to transfer, Jacob Eason, when he was a freshman at Georgia, had 6.5 adjusted yards per attempt. So he's not even close to that standard. Is the lowest threshold I'm setting is maybe I'll consider they should consider a quarterback change.
So you won't jump off the bandwagon?
No,
it's just not happening.
68% of his passes last year. This is insane.
By all accounts, in spring practice, he's jacked.
By all accounts, the defense is way ahead of the offense, which I don't know exactly what to read into that. But
I mean, I think the defense is going to be awesome.
I think so, too. All right, next up, we're turning to you on this one. The aforementioned runner-up in our women's NCAA tournament pool, Noah Cohen, at Noah Cohen asks, more exciting, D. Gordon on the M's or Zlatan in MLS?
Figuring out how to pronounce Zlatan. Zlatan is the more exciting. It's tough because seeing D. Gordon, in my takes later, I actually deleted a D. Gordon paragraph or a D. Gordon sentence from the takes. It got cut at the very end.
It was the fourth guest on Carson.
But it was Matt Damon on Kimmel.
Yeah.
But when he hit that homer on Saturday and then watched it just like Ken Griffey Jr. on Sunday, that was pretty amazing.
And we should definitely get used to that because D. Gordon hits a lot of home runs, right?
Yes. He's been working out with Ken Griffey Jr., so I'm expecting him to be at least 45 this year.
Speaking of Griffey, did you see LeBron's Griffey shoes that he wore in the game Tuesday night?
No.
It was like the Griffey, classic Griffey Air Max inspired LeBron.
Really?
Yeah, it was pretty awesome.
Wow, good for LeBron. But all that is to say, Zlatan in the MLS.
Nope, that was not.
Zlatan in the MLS is still more exciting.
Well, I mean, this defends to some extent on your definition of exciting. By the way, D. Gordon for his career after Sunday has 12 home runs. But that's only in 3,000 plate appearances or so. So, you know, expect a lot more this season. Zlatan playing for the LA Galaxy is actually terrifying, not exciting.
It's like, exciting that people are talking about the MLS, though.
Those goals were so incredible on Saturday. I had this originally in the notes for the Sounders section, but we'll discuss it here. So he made his debut for the Galaxy in the 71st minute, a game they originally trailed to LAFC, their crosstown rivals in what is now known as El Tráfico. They were down 3-0. Zlatan scores twice, once from about 30 yards out, and then another incredible finish, and the Galaxy come back to win that match 4-3.
And in 19 minutes, he now has two more goals than the Sounders have for the entire season.
Oh, no. It's sad but true.
I mean, he seems like the rare player who is still relatively close to his peak strength and playing in the MLS. Like, we might actually get to experience, like, a superhuman-type player playing against MLS defenses.
I mean, I don't think this should be that surprising, because before his ACL injury, he was a really, really good player in the EPL, even at advanced age. So, you know, I think the expectations should have been pretty high for him, I guess is what I would say.
Especially set by himself.
he's never shied away from high expectations, no.
But having the MLS on a weekend, on Easter weekend, there's a lot of stuff going on. There's college basketball. There's the beginning of the baseball season. There's NBA playoffs just about to start. Having the MLS be a story on that weekend is something that's a little bit unheard of.
Yeah, that's true. Drew, that's pretty cool. All right, our last question that we have this week in the mailbag. Alex Walker, at Alex Walker Hydro, asks, what sort of niche Seattle sports do you think you would cover? Ultimate Frisbee? Rugby?
We already cover hydroplanes, so you know the sky's the limit here.
That's pretty niche. And in intense Seattle Storm coverage, so that's getting decently niche in its own right.
UW softball, all sorts of things. I mean, if there was a competitive Seattle rugby team, especially if they had a rivalry with Portland or Vancouver.
Did you know that there is a Seattle rugby team that's starting play this year?
Oh, really? Oh, we should add it to the rundown.
The Seattle Seawolves, it appears.
Frisbee might be too far for me, though.
You know, it's funny. Frisbee came up once before because of the fact that we were talking about possible names for the Seattle NHL team. And I believe it's the Sockeye was on there. And there's a Seattle Sockeye's Ultimate Frisbee team.
Oh, really?
One of my good friends from high school was a player on that team for a long period of time.
On the Sockeyes? Yeah. To me, that's like the favorite for the team name.
So he, like, back in college was trying to get me into, like, Ultimate Frisbee, advanced stats, or, like, journalism. And I think still would have been ahead of my time there.
Ultimate Frisbee advanced stats.
I imagine they must exist.
Who is this? Wait, who is this person?
Ray Ilion.
And they have Ultimate Frisbee advanced stats.
I don't know if they do, but I assume they must. I'm not.
You could have
actively
been the
following.
Bill James of Ultimate Frisbee. It
really could have been.
It was just sitting there for you.
It was. It is all true. So when did the Seattle Seawolves start play? I believe it's not. I assume they have a summer season, so I think it's must be coming up here.
This is the rugby team?
Yeah.
That we're following closely?
Looks like April 22nd is their first game.
I'm trying to think of anything else competitive that we'd pay attention to.
They will be playing at Starfire.
Oh, so, well, look at that. Go. How convenient.
There you go.
I'm going to start getting you to start doing stats for Baby Fantasy Geniuses baseball games.
Yes, his on-base percentage was decent on Saturday.
No, it was zero.
He didn't get on base the last
time?
No,
he didn't get on base.
That's right.
Okay. He was the only player in the entire game not to swing at every single pitch, though.
Yeah, that's true. He took a ball, so we're working on his eye.
And learn the term check swing.
Yep, that's also true.
He checked his swing before he even knew that it existed.
Okay, so that's all the questions we had. Should we turn our attention to more specifically to sports? And beginning, I think, with the NBA section, where we have a lot to cover this week. Let's start with Markelle Fultz, who has now kind of settled into a regular reserve role after making his return for the Sixers last week. He, since coming back from his shoulder injury, he's played 84 minutes, scored 37 points, handed out 22 assists against just 3 turnovers, has 13 rebounds. He is shooting 43.6%, all on twos, has yet to attempt a three-pointer this season, and is 3 of 5 at the free throw line. And the Sixers remain on fire despite Joel Embiid's fractured orbital bone that he suffered in an untimely collision with Fultz.
Suffered at the face of Markelle Fultz. What do you make of the start for Markelle?
It's encouraging. I mean, you still like to see him making more outside shots, and he's not very efficient in large part because of the fact that he isn't. But he's able to make a lot of plays, and I think his passing has been maybe a little ahead of where I would have expected at this point.
Really?
Yeah.
Do you feel like an outside shot is something that is ever going to enter his repertoire?
We don't know, but I mean,
he was a good three-point shooter in college.
Yeah.
We would have not expected at this point. I mean, a lot of things that have happened with Markelle Fultz we wouldn't have expected, but
when he has shot, it's looked certainly much better than it did earlier in the season. We haven't seen him really shoot a catch-and-shoot jumper that I can remember, and that's what eventually he's going to have to do, especially if he plays with Ben Simmons, which he did for the first time briefly on Tuesday night, but I wasn't watching the game at that point, so I don't know how it went.
So he normally is not on the court at the same time.
They've basically exclusively been using him as Simmons' backup.
I was watching the Sixers game on Sunday and was disappointed that I didn't see more Markelle.
He did play 21 minutes on Tuesday. I mean, they had a blowout, so that got him some more time, but he's very in the mix for them, and presumably at this point will be as they go into the playoffs, right now looking like they're going to have home court advantage in the first round.
Kind of a crazy situation. So to me, it's about him not playing that badly, building up confidence, and then eventually being able to start working on the next pieces of his game.
So as one former UW point guard is back in the mix, sadly another UW point guard, is sidelined. Isaiah Thomas underwent surgery last week to remove loose bodies from his hip. Now, this is not as serious as the hip labrum surgery that he passed on last year. It's not an indication that that labrum tear did not heal, but there's still a four-month timetable for rehab, and that means he will not yet have been back on the court by the time he becomes an unrestricted free agent on July 1st. So it's going to be very interesting to see what the market holds for Isaiah Thomas coming off this disappointing injury-marred season for him.
Let me give you a bold prediction, but maybe a not-so-bold prediction. Isaiah Thomas will not be signed by the opening day of the NBA season next year.
That's a really bold prediction. Like, you think he's going to choose not to play because he's not happy with any of the offers?
It could be. I mean, it could be anything. Just that's the prediction is what it is.
I mean, certainly someone's going to offer him a contract to try to see if they can get him back to where he was in Boston. And I think that team very likely will be the Lakers unless they go out and sign two max free agents. Because in the event they don't do that, their entire thought process is going to be, how can we maintain cap space for the summer of 2019? And signing Thomas to a big one-year deal is a convenient way to do that.
I definitely don't think he's getting paid anything that you would call a big one-year deal.
All right, relatively big compared to what the other offers would be. And especially if they don't sign any free agents, then, you know, they have full bird rights on him. It really doesn't matter what they pay him as long as they don't go into the luxury tax. So I think that's his best hope, is for the Lakers to strike out in free agency. Isaiah is rooting for LeBron to go elsewhere. On the Blazers front, they got first some bad news. Tuesday is a rough loss for them against the lottery bound, let's say, Dallas Mavericks, who finished the game with a lineup of, no, Aaron Harrison was at point guard. Maxi Kleber made a couple big threes down the stretch. It was not great for the Blazers.
With a lineup with five players who you could have done who he play for me, and I would not have gotten a single one.
Yep.
You want to say your line about it's lucky who the Blazers don't have to play in the playoffs?
It's very likely they won't have to play the Grizzlies or the Mavericks in the playoffs. They're not possible matchups. But the Blazers are still three games up on the Spurs for the third seed because the LA Clippers came from behind and beat San Antonio later Tuesday night on TNT in a game we just finished watching. So the Blazers have a magic number of two now for the third seed, which is big because if San Antonio had won that game, I think they would have been favored to get the three seed.
That is insane. All right, tell me these schedules. Tell me why that's the case. With a two-game buffer with like five games left, how the Blazers could not have been favored for the three seed.
All right, here's the Blazers' remaining games. They play at Houston on Thursday.
Not trying.
No, they are trying. They beat Washington by like 20 tonight.
Without Chris Paul.
Yeah. San Antonio on Saturday in a game that will decide the head-to-head season series and the tiebreaker between the two teams. And then Monday at Denver to conclude a four-game road trip at Mile High, which is always where you want to finish a road trip. And then they come home and finish the regular season, their final game of the regular season at home against Utah next Wednesday.
I mean, it's so a hard schedule.
They're not going to be favored any of their remaining road games.
Who does San Antonio have left? They won't be favored in Denver?
No.
Ugh, you're crazy.
With home court advantage, the Nuggets are clearly favored over the Blazers. The Spurs' other remaining games besides the Blazers.
We don't have to start talking about how much you're hating on the Blazers now.
Look, home court advantage is very important. Are you unaware of this?
Okay, well,
is this your first time watching basketball?
It's a good thing that we'll have it through the first round.
Probably. At the Lakers on Wednesday. Monday versus Sacramento at New Orleans on Wednesday. So the Spurs would be favored in three of their remaining four games. They probably would not be favored at New Orleans because the Pelicans have home court advantage, and that's a thing.
So the Blazers need to win at San Antonio.
If they win at San Antonio, it's over.
Then they don't have to worry about anything
else.
They
have the three seed because their magic number is two to get the three seed right now. And to clinch home court advantage, all they have to do is beat the Jazz. That's all that's necessary. So they're still looking pretty good for home court advantage. But it's a little dicey, especially because Damian Lillard hobbled off after the game, was carted to the team bus after suffering a sprained left ankle against the Mavericks. So not ideal timing for that. And here's what I would tell you. Here is my hot take, is Damian Lillard should not play against the Rockets. And the Blazers should strictly be thinking about this Saturday game against San Antonio and beyond.
It's all falling apart. I love the Blazers too much. This is just like the Huskies after Arizona. I agree with you, though, that they should just let that Rockets game go.
All right, so the other question we had was from Austin Wise, at Austin J. Wise, who asked, would be interested to hear who fellow Blazer fan at Tristan Garcino wants to face in the playoffs. I think 3 Blazers versus 6 Pels and 2 Warriors versus 7 Thunder is ideal. Thoughts, at K. Pelton. Congrats on 100 episodes. Big fan of the music segment / episodes. All right, so what do you got?
I mean, I mostly defer to you on this. The one thing is, to me, it's tough because the one team that really looms, and this is where they're at as of this moment, which is 3 Blazers, 6 Thunder. And it's a playoff series that we have never seen, right?
Not in this format, certainly, although I'm sure that many outlets, including my own, would refer to the storied history of Blazers Thunder's playoff matchups, last of which was in 1991, according to them.
Which we definitely do not recognize here on the Pelton Cast.
No, we certainly do not. It's weird, by the way, that the Blazers and the Sonics didn't play in the last 17 years that they were.
It's kind of amazing that neither iteration of the franchise. I mean, really, the chances, considering that the Thunder and the Blazers have been in the playoffs most of the last 10 years.
Yeah, it's really improbable
that they haven't ever played each other. Provided everyone is healthy, and there's a giant knock on wood, if this ankle injury to Damian Lillard isn't an issue, if Maurice Harkless comes back, if Mo Harkless is back, and the Blazers are at full strength, bring on the Thunder! We want the Thunder! However, let's say that maybe the Blazers aren't at 100%, then let's let the Warriors handle them and get them into the 7th seed, right? I mean, really, I would prefer the Thunder not make the playoffs at all. I'm still holding out hope for this, which you tell me I'm crazy to do.
It's a long shot. I mean, so to me, New Orleans is clearly the most favorable matchup.
Minnesota looks like...
Yeah, but they'll probably have Jimmy Butler back by that point, so...
That's iffy.
They're a totally different team with Jimmy Butler. I mean, they before Jimmy Butler got hurt, they were probably going to be the 3 seed.
Minnesota without Jimmy... It's tough for all teams because they all have caveats. The teams that I don't want to face, I definitely do not want to face Utah.
No, Utah is probably the 3rd best team in the Western Conference. They are the 3rd best by point differential.
Continue with your hate. Blazers hate. Clearly the number 3 seed. Easily and by record, hottest team in the NBA in the second half. But you know, the Jazz are the best team. Are the 3rd best team in the West.
Point differential, the validity of point differential just to hate on the Blazers.
Don't want to face the Jazz. So, I mean, it really comes down to that the Pelicans are the most obvious answer. I like the idea of playing the Thunder because if the Blazers end the Thunder season, that would be so amazing.
The
stakes are definitely the highest there. But I would get so many people in Seattle to rally around my cause as a Blazers fan. All of a sudden, it wouldn't just be me and my Blazers. It would be the city of Seattle and our Blazers.
That is probably true.
Which I kind of like. At the same time, I like almost guaranteeing that the Thunder are defeated in the first round, Paul George leaving.
Lastly, on the basketball front, let's discuss last Saturday. The Naismith Memorial Basketball Hall of Fame announced their 2018 class, which includes 4 players and 1 contributor with Seattle ties. Most notably among that group, of course, Ray Allen, who was elected to the Hall of Fame in his first year of eligibility.
Toaster Ray Allen, by the way.
Oh, yeah, of course. Legendary Sonic. Also, Rod Thorne, a member of the inaugural Sonics who played with the team from 1967 through 1970 and was 3rd on the team in scoring at 15.2 points per game their first season, was chosen as a contributor primarily on the strength of his career as an executive. Also on the player side, both Katie Smith and Tina Thompson, who played together for the Storm in 2012. Katie Smith was also here in 2011, and Thompson finished her career with the Storm in 2013, going in the Hall of Fame together in their first year of eligibility. Very fitting for the two of them, who were pioneers, kind of the last 2 remaining inaugural players, 2 of the all-time leading scorers in women's basketball. And it was really awesome to get the chance to cover both of them, as well as Ray Allen, during my time working for the Sonics and Storm. And then lastly, Rick Welts, the Seattle native and UW grad who began his career in the NBA with the Sonics, first off as a ball boy and later working in the front office, then moved to the NBA league office where he was instrumental in the creation of All-Star Saturday Night as well as the WNBA, subsequently became president of first the Suns and now the Golden State Warriors, and is a driving force in the preseason game anticipated to be played in Seattle.
What's
this October?
Toast to Rick Welts also.
Yeah, to all of these people.
To everybody. Bringing it back home. Would Ray Allen be a fun 3rd Pelton brother?
I think so.
All right.
Yeah. I don't know if we're part of his media tour for his new book that's coming out. I don't think so. By the way, Jimmy also suggested LeVar Ball was the third Pelton brother, since he's doing a media blitz for the youth basketball league. He's starting up. They're having tryouts in Seattle this Saturday.
Really?
They are.
We should have Katie interview him.
We are going to have some, we may have some content out of that, but I don't think it will involve LeVar Ball.
Are we going to have content?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. Hopefully. That's the plan.
Content I don't even know about.
All right. On the NHL to Seattle front, new arena interior renderings were released by the Oakview Group for the new arena at Seattle Center. Not really a lot of surprises there. Indicated, as we've known all along, that the entrance, like ground level, will be even with the upper bowl in the new arena, and with the event floor being 60 feet below ground as they dig even farther down to create more space for that rebuilt arena.
Okay.
All right, let's talk about the Sounders in crisis. A 1-0 loss on Saturday to the Montreal Impact dropped them to 0-3-0 this season. They are the only in MLS play. They are the only team in the MLS with no points so far this season. But here's the good news.
There's good news.
Still have not scored a goal.
Is the good news that the Galaxy have Zlatan?
The good news is they also started 0-3-0 in 2016, and you know how that season ended.
Oh, wow.
They won the MLS Cup. So for the third consecutive game.
Did they score a goal in those three games?
Probably they scored a goal. For the third consecutive game, the Sounders had a player sent off. This time it was defender Kelvin Leerdam, right back Kelvin Leerdam, who was red carded in the 40th minute for a slap to the face of Montreal's Daniel Lovitz. Playing shorthanded, the down a man, the Sounders allowed a goal to Jason Vargas in the 60th minute for the only score in this game. Brian Schmetzer post-match said, players make mistakes, but the mistakes, in terms of red cards, that is, have to stop happening. If the mistakes don't stop happening, then guys don't stay on the field.
No shit.
Presumably the Sounders will not have a player red card in every match this season.
You don't know.
And presumably at some point they will get Clint Dempsey back from red card suspension after another bye week this weekend, which is probably well-timed in terms of just getting everyone healthier and in a better place mentally.
Oh my God.
But here's the real good news. The Sounders actually have still been pretty good in terms of expected goals. It's really very similar to last season, and possibly even 2016 when we weren't tracking this as closely, where their performance in terms of goals didn't match up to, you know, the expectations in terms of their possession, the kind of shots they were getting, those sorts of things. The Sounders on Saturday had, according to 538 Soccer Power Index model, a 1.7 to 0.8 advantage in shot-based expected goals, and a 2.0 to 0.5 advantage in non-shot goals. And then if we switch over to the season-long perspective of American soccer analysis expected goals, they have 4.4 expected goals scored this season, which ranks 14th on a per-game basis. I mean, the offense has not been good by any measure, but it's not bad enough that they shouldn't have scored at all.
No, and even just from watching the game, even being a man down, the Sounders had quite a few chances.
Yeah, until they gave up the goal, they really, it felt like, were more likely to score in this game than Montreal was.
So, I mean, I feel like that all checks out just from the eye test watching it. The Sounders were a little bit unlucky here.
A lot unlucky, I think, and have been now in both of their home matches out of these three matches. I mean, they were dominated in the game. They lost 3-0 in Dallas. Again, getting Clint Dempsey back will help. I mean, one of the things that this is exposed is without, you know, with the injury to Morris, Jordan Morris, there's not a lot of depth up front. If one striker is out, all of a sudden you are hugely compromised in that area with just Will Bruin.
And I think it's someplace where when the transfer window is open this summer, they're going to have to find somebody. They're going to have to find an attacking player.
Yeah, they need more depth there. There's no question about it.
I should see if that Zlatan guy is available. I think he's pretty good.
I don't think the Galaxy are solid at this point, I would say. All right. It's time for presumably an optimistic version of your favorite segment.
Don't burn yourself. We got Mariners hot takes coming at you.
Did you hear about that Kendrick and Dr. Dre mixtape that was on the internet today?
I did not hear about that.
You know, I thought it was cool, but you know what it was missing?
What was it missing?
Some Mariners takes included.
Oh, no.
Let me just strap on my old English Renton hat here. You know what year the Mariners are channeling right now?
What year?
Dr. Dre knows. It's not 2001, as you might imagine. That's right. 95 plus no pennies. Add that shit up. But before the season, no one said they could win the Wild Wild West, a division that's untouchable, like Elliot Ness. I think. But Scott Servais had a dream. Jerry DePoto had a dream. No trophies in the case. Fuck that. And now the Mariners are rolling to the safe, smoking Indo, sipping on wins and juice. Let me just break down some elements that are in their DNA. Murder was the case they gave Edwin Diaz because he's killing hitters in the ninth. Nowadays, everybody want to talk like they got something to say, but nothing comes out when they move their lips. Just a bunch of gibberish, and motherfuckers act like they forgot about the king. When your ticket sales weren't doing too good, who's the king they told you to go see? Nelson Cruz, before he was injured, falling on the stairs. Just ignore that part. Prove that he's realer than real deal Holyfield, the king of Seattle, the king of the coast. Even if Lou Piniella came back, still no coaching him. He's usually homeboys with the hitters he's hitting with, but this is baseball, and they need to know what time it is. I'm talking Seager, Segura, Suzuki, Zunino, Kirk Nieuwenhuis, Guillermo Heredia, Mike Marjama. He's trying to mess up all your ops, trying to send you back to single A. I got a bone to pick. Now, do you know what that's from?
I got a bone to pick?
No, no, the whole
thing. Send you back to single A?
The control verse.
Yeah.
Now, you might say it's only a 4-game sample size, but bitch, don't kill my vibe. Because I got Robbie, got Edgar, got Haniger inside my dugout, and we gonna be all right. Because you know all the stars are Mariners. So just chill till the next episode.
It's early, but I can guarantee that's going to be the best of Feltcast 101 through 200.
That's not. A lot of Felton cast to go.
Like I'm overreacting to a small sample size, much like you lie about the Mariners. No, I mean 3-1 is a great start. Despite the Nelson Cruz injury, which is like, why does baseball, exclusively baseball, has the craziest injuries? Like nothing like this ever happens in basketball. No one ever like runs up to the bench and is high-fiving someone and gets injured while doing that. That just doesn't happen in basketball.
Maybe because people are actual athletes in other sports.
That is a possibility.
It's like watching Baby Fantasy Genius play baseball, and I'm like, we were talking about what position he should play, and I'm like, you've got just the gait of a catcher. I'm like, you've got the speed around the base paths of a catcher.
So Cruz, when he was placed on the 10-day DL on Tuesday, joined Mike Zunino, who was there with an oblique strain, of course, unexpectedly missed opening day, and then was subsequently placed on the DL, but manager Scott Servais said that Zunino could rejoin the team on this road trip, which, again, they started by beating the Giants, spoiling San Francisco's opening day.
There it is. Finally spoiling somebody else's opening day for once.
Yeah. You can feel the excitement.
After these four games, Mina Kimes is excited.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're all excited.
Third Pelton brother Chris Smith is excited. So we'll see. And in a week, we could feel totally differently. That's the beauty of Mariners hot takes. Why you love them. On the UW sports front, we start with Noah Dickerson announcing on Instagram last week that he is entering the NBA draft, but not hiring an agent. Here's what he said. I am looking at this as a time where I can receive feedback and get better while keeping my college eligibility.
Okay, he's coming back.
I mean, there is no NBA interest in Noah Dickerson, who is a phenomenal college player, but is a 6'8" center at the college level. That's, you know, his best position offensively and defensively as an NBA player's center, and he's 6'8". So it just doesn't really work for him at that level.
Is he gonna play foreign basketball?
Oh, certainly he'd be very effective overseas or in the G League.
Noah Dickerson can finish. It's just like he has to be able to play basketball somewhere.
Yeah, he'll get paid to play basketball.
He's a professional basketball player.
Not in the NBA.
Are we surprised that nobody else has done the same thing?
I mean, there's no rush to do it. I think the deadline, I believe, is April 20th for players to declare for the draft. So, you know, they could be doing it at their own pace. Again, I would expect Matisse Thybulle to, at the very least, declare for the draft for that reason. Because as we've discussed in the past, there is zero downside if you're a junior to doing it and withdrawing your name. You do get this feedback, and that can be useful. UW softball swept Stanford last weekend in dominant fashion in Palo Alto, at scoring the lowly Cardinal 27-1.
There we go.
Over the three games.
27-1.
Need some UW softball hot takes.
Revenge for Bryce Love.
They face,
because we're a softball school now.
Yeah. They face Seattle U on Wednesday in a one-off game and then host Utah this weekend. The Utes are just 2-7-0 in Pac-12 play so far. I don't know why I put ties in there. They have that in the Pac-12 standings, but I don't know if you even can tie in softball.
Every team in sports where they don't have ties are NO.
It's very true. We didn't even mention it with the Blazers, but they are not tied this year. We wrap up this week in kind of the abbreviated sports section, since there's not a ton going on, with the Seahawks, who were relatively quiet in free agency over the last week. The only move of note that cornerback Justin Coleman signed his $2.9 million tender as a restricted free agent and will be back, presumably to start at nickelback for the Seahawks.
Great. Yep. Love Justin Coleman.
$2.9 million is a lot of money for that position, but you know it is a starting position at this point, given how much the nickel corner is on the field, especially relative to your weak side linebacker. So, yeah.
And Justin Coleman was good last year.
He was very good in that role.
He's a fine nickel cornerback. But can we talk about Brandon Cooks for a second?
Okay.
I talked to you about this offline.
You did.
But do you want to pull up the... We could pause here for a second and pull up the principles of the trade. I guess I knew what this trade was.
So the Rams dealt the 23rd overall pick in this year's draft, their first rounder, along with a 6th round pick to the New England Patriots for Cooks and a 4th round pick.
So it's amazing to me, not to say that this won't work out in the short term for the Rams, but it's amazing to me how little the Rams have learned from mistakes that teams in their division also made.
So the situation is pretty similar for the Rams to where the Seahawks were, I guess, in either 2012 or 2013, probably after 2012, where you've got 3 years remaining of, or 2 years remaining of a cheap quarterback.
It's also for the Rams, just one caveat here. Jared Goff is not that cheap of a quarterback.
No, because
he's cheap compared to market value for quarterbacks. But we're comparing him to market. I mean, granted, Jared Goff most likely is going to get paid a lot of money.
But Russell Wilson was like making the league minimum, basically.
Russell Wilson was a really cheap quarterback.
It was pretty great, wasn't it? And then it turned out that was short-lived. And then everything got really expensive because also at the same time, the Seahawks defensive players got a lot more expensive.
Should have tried to win the Super Bowl a second time.
They tried. Really did try.
But the Rams, so what they're doing with this Brandon Cooks trade, I understand the argument is that they're like going all in on the season, which, hey, that always works.
Worked so well for the Seahawks last year. They're trying to maximize this period where they have Jared Goff on a cheap contract and be as successful as they can during it.
By giving away other players who would be on cheap contracts? That's the thing to me that I don't understand. The Rams don't have a draft pick before the 3rd round.
Yep. I saw somewhere, I don't know where this was, so I can't give credit, that their entire draft value combined now is like a low 3rd round pick.
It's insane. But so they're not approaching this in the same way that the Seahawks would approach this. The Seahawks still, they've traded draft picks.
They approach it a little bit in the way the Seahawks would approach this.
But the Seahawks value draft picks very highly.
Unless they're trading for stars, which is how clearly the Rams see Brandon Cooks.
I don't know if I necessarily... I looked up immediately his DVOA because I want it to be really bad. And he's like the 15th best receiver or something. Worse than Cooper Kupp.
Playing with Tom Brady.
He was also... Well, he was playing with Drew Brees beforehand. Like, he's going from two of the best quarterbacks in the NFL to Jared Goff.
Who's fine.
Who's maybe fine. But to me, it's more amazing what the Patriots did here is that the Patriots paid basically the same as what they got back for the Rams. They got a better first-round pick for one season of Brandon Cooks at like $1.5 million. And when they were going to have to pay Brandon Cooks like $8.5 million, all of a sudden they get that first-round pick back plus the mid-round pick. And the Rams are paying him the $8.5 million, plus they're going to have to deal with him as a free agent next year. This was like one of the greatest heists that I've ever seen. They basically got a year of Brandon Cooks for almost free.
So Bill Barnwell did the math on this and his trade grades and found out that the difference between the picks that the Patriots sent out in the two Cooks trades and the ones that they took in was equivalent to the 199th overall selection.
Okay.
That's what they paid to get a full year of Brandon Cooks at the aforementioned $1.5 million.
For like nothing. I mean, it's such an amazing thing that the Patriots were able to do here.
It really is a pretty incredible. You know, in soccer, the expression is, oh, it's a nice piece of business when you like buy a player for a low amount and sell them for a high amount. And that's what this is for the Patriots. It's a nice piece of business. But by the way, it's surprising to note then that Barnwell's grade for the Patriots is only a B+, and for the Rams is a C+.
I really don't get that. Because to me, this is... a D trade for the Rams, because what they're doing is they're not only giving up the first-round pick for Brandon Cooks, they're having to pay him at a much higher salary this year than he was making beforehand.
Probably, I mean, not quite market rate, but close to it.
It's a little bit of a deal at $8.5 million.
But not enough to be worth a first-round pick. I mean, this is...
But then they also have him as a free agent next year, which if things work out well, they're going to have to try to re-sign him. Maybe they franchise him. Who knows?
But they also have this guy named Aaron Donald to deal with.
It is just... They all of a sudden have self-inflicted these wounds to their cap starting next year. I mean, it's been an insane way to approach this offseason.
The important way to think about this, and we've learned this the hard way, I think, as Seahawks fans with Deion Branch and Percy Harvin and,
God,
to an extent, Jimmy Graham, and then also Sheldon Richardson.
And it just keeps, like, they just keep going.
You don't trade for a player. You trade for a contract. And so this is probably most clearly true of the Harvin trade. If you both give up the first round pick and give the player the big contract, then you haven't really gotten anything because you're still paying the player what you would have paid to go out and get an equivalent free agent. So you can't just look at this play, like, you know, people will say, oh, who's more likely to be more productive, Brandon Cooks or a wide receiver you would draft at 23rd? And the answer is obviously Brandon Cooks, but that's not the equation.
Unless you draft Cooper Kupp.
The equation is Brandon Cooks or the 23rd pick and whoever you get with the money you're not spending on Brandon Cooks. That's the way you have to think about it.
Well, and plus the money next year on Brandon Cooks, too.
Well, I mean, they don't have to pay that. It's not a sunk cost at this point.
But then otherwise, they've given up a first-round pick for paying Brandon Cooks for 1 year.
But it's not like that shouldn't be a justification for overpaying Brandon Cooks.
No, it should be a reason to not train for Brandon Cooks.
Yes, I mean, I agree with that.
It's just amazing to me that they made this trade. And also, Brandon Cooks is not... Look, the real thing is that you shouldn't trade first-round picks unless you are getting maybe like a team-changing quarterback, right? Like if the 49ers would have known how good Jimmy Garoppolo was going to be and could have gone back and traded a first-round pick, they probably still would have done it.
Yeah, probably.
But he's having a quarterback...
He's also getting paid a lot of money.
But having a quarterback who's at that level is an organizational altering thing.
Also, they would have probably just spent the money on fullbacks anyway.
They would have paid Richard Sherman more money. But spending that much capital, both as far as the salary cap and the draft pick that you're giving up for a receiver who's like maybe one of the 10 best receivers in the game. Like, is Brandon Cooks going to completely change the Rams offense? Is adding that weapon going to make them that much better than they would be? I mean, it's a shocking trade to me.
He's certainly more durable than Sammy Watkins and probably a bit better as a player. But again...
What did they trade for Sammy Watkins, though, right?
They traded their second-round pick for Sammy Watkins, right?
Oh, they traded their second-round pick for Sammy Watkins last year?
Yes.
Wow! My God!
That was one of two things that made me feel better about the Seahawks future Tuesday. The other one being, did you see the story from ESPN.com about the failed vote on whether to use video on the sidelines? You probably should have seen this because I definitely chatted it to you, where a bunch of NFL coaches deliver Luddite takes on like how horrible it would be if they use video on the sidelines, because that's like a crutch. And when you study something off a picture, which, by the way, is a form of technology,
I know,
like pictures like understand. Always invented existed, like they had to be invented too, just like video. That would undermine coaching as we know it.
They but made it seem like coaching is perfect. If you have video, any moron could coach perfectly if you had video.
Yes.
But pictures, people can't master pictures in the same way.
But there was one dissenter in this article.
There we go.
And that dissenter was Peter Clay Carroll, who had this to say. We've had experience with using video in practice, so guys are already starting to adapt. Some coaches use it more than others, and some players take to it more than others. It's just more information, which sounds classic for our time, but I think it will work out fine. Like, what a sensible take from Pete.
Okay. No, it's nice to see the most youthful man in the room.
Exactly.
Literally being the oldest man in the room.
It's amazing. It remains amazing. Like, as frustrating as Pete Carroll can sometimes be because of his insistence on running the football at all times, like, the guy is still much more willing to change than nearly any NFL coach. And that's great. So I'm going to take that note of optimism with me as we go forward into the week ahead.
So we smash into the offensive line, first down and second down, and hope Russell Wilson can bail us out every single series next year until the fourth quarter.
Well, maybe with video, they would be able to fix that. On that note,
thanks for listening.
Thanks.